Welcome to the first in a series of classes and discussions on this topic of the self, something very dear to us, something that's this key, pivotal topic in maybe all spiritual practice, but definitely Buddhism. This issue of what is the self of the person, and clarifying what that is, and it is basically the pivot point between liberation, even what we might call nirvana, the total freedom from suffering, and the bondage of suffering and stuck self grasping from the very earliest times, from the Buddha's very first teachings, all the way up to the growth of the Mahayana in India, China, Japan, Zen, Tibetan Buddhism, all revolves around this issue. And there's, you could say there's more to it than that. We talk about emptiness often, like in the Heart Sutra, there's emptiness of all these different dharmas, all these different phenomena. And for full, complete Buddhahood, one has to deeply realize the complete emptiness of all things. But one of the things, in a way we could say, phenomena that are empty is the self of the person. So it's this particular thing to focus on, and it's usually within Mahayana, Great Vehicle Buddhism, where emptiness teachings are so emphasized. It's usually broken down into these two aspects. So there's the emptiness of all phenomena, and there's emptiness of the self, of the person. So it's that important that it's like its own category. It doesn't just get lumped into all phenomena. In other words, it's like, and there's different meditations and understandings and investigations for the person. And partly why it's broken into these two parts is because all, even early Buddhist teachings and like Theravada Buddhism also says that this understanding the selflessness or identitylessness of the person is the key to liberation. And they don't go as far as saying all phenomena are empty. That's a kind of a Mahayana thing. But then so the Mahayana says, well, we have these two parts. We all agree that there's no inherently existent abiding self of the person. And we can go further and look at all phenomena being empty, which is last year we studied Nagarjuna's first chapter, which was about emptiness of all phenomena. And so now that we're taking this chapter 18 of Nagarjuna, this is second century, sometimes called the second Buddha, really important practitioner and philosopher, investigator of what is. And so we could say that particularly the first verse of chapter 1, for those who remember last year who took Nagarjuna's class about, what is it like, neither from itself, nor from another, nor from both, nor from neither does anything whatsoever anywhere arise. That's the first verse of Nagarjuna's 27 chapter verses on the middle way. And the rest of the chapter kind of comments on that unusual verse, which was quite difficult for those who were here and took that class. I feel like this might not be quite as challenging or a little less abstract, because it's about this very tangible thing of me, I, the self. So chapter 18, all the way through these different chapters of Nagarjuna investigating these different topics, chapter 18 is particularly on the self, we're talking about of the person. So the other chapters are on all these different phenomena of experience. And now we're going to investigate examine the self. So chapter 18 is called Atma Pariksha, examination of the Atman, or self. And again, these two kinds of identitylessness, the identitylessness of the, or emptiness of the person, and emptiness of all phenomena. Like in the Tibetan tradition, Chandrakirti is another great Indian teacher who basically tried to summarize Nagarjuna's teachings and pack them all into this, what he called the introduction to the middle way. And maybe it's about the same length as Nagarjuna's verses on the middle way, but it's like takes the central topics and packs them into one. And it's basically, the whole book is on commenting, you could say, on these two verses. The first verse of chapter one, about neither arising from itself nor from another, both or neither. And this first verse of chapter 18, that the self of the person is neither the same as nor different from the body and mind, is basically the verse, which we'll get into. And so this is a somewhat short chapter. I'll pass out the whole chapter. It all fits on one page. It's like 12, 14 verses, something like that. And but really, I think the first verse, even if we don't get, I don't even have the obsession with necessarily having to finish this chapter, even though it's only 12 verses, because really the first, and I think the second verse also is an important derivation from the first, but I think we could easily spend 6 classes just talking about this first verse, even though it's in a way pretty straightforward. And I just feel like this is one of the greatest. Let me just. There's two different handouts here. Why don't you take one as I'm speaking? Personally, I feel like this is one of my favorite topics. This self of the person. I think it's juicier than Nagarjuna's first chapter, because it's so, again, so close to home. It's about who are we, actually? Who am I? And as I got into this and felt like how turning this kind of investigation can be, I was heartened by hearing that Tsongkhapa, who's one of the, in the Tibetan tradition, Tibetan Gelugpa tradition, he's like the main practitioner and philosopher and writer. And this is like the Dalai Lama's school of Tibetan Buddhism. Tsongkhapa in the, 14th century, something like that. That he, after practicing, after studying Nagarjuna, that was kind of his main topic, studying his middle way philosophy and practicing on retreat, a lot of meditation for years and years, and feeling like a lot of understanding there, but still it wasn't quite complete. Apparently he had this this dream about Nagarjuna, and different other commentators on Nagarjuna, like Chandrakirti and so on, kind of like talking about the understanding of the middle way, and then they kind of like, in the dream, they kind of like hit him on the head with the book. And he kind of like woke up from the dream, and he thought, this was a really auspicious dream. I feel like really clear right now. So he went back to his study and picked up the book of commentaries on Nagarjuna that he happened to be studying. And he just happened to be at the beginning of chapter 18 here. And he read this one verse, the first verse of chapter 18. And he said, suddenly, like, all the deep meaning of the middle way just like completely poured into him completely. And he said, all my years of understanding Nagarjuna before this was completely upside down. Now it's like really, it's completely different. And it's like, there's no doubt here. It was like his great breakthrough for this great teacher. So on this one verse, right, he read the verse. And then there's this great book that's on the reading list that I passed out by the Dalai Lama, the current Dalai Lama, called How to Know Yourself as You Really Are, that he tries to make this topic that we're just, this investigation of self, kind of accessible. It's still kind of difficult, I think. But he tells his personal story. I thought maybe I'd just even read, because I thought this was surprising. It's the same verse that he had, this kind of like, and also very, for the Dalai Lama, this is very personal. He doesn't usually talk about his own, you know, he's so humble. He says, I'm just an ordinary monk. I don't really understand all this stuff, but I like to study it, you know. But here he says, when I was about 35 years old, this is like a, just came out a couple years ago, I think, this book. I was reflecting on the meaning of a passage by Tsongkhapa, that teacher, about how the I, you know, the I in quotes, the I cannot be found either within or separate from the mind and body, and how the I depends for its existence on conceptuality. And he quotes the passage on this. Well, maybe I'll just read it, since we might, I thought we could come back to it later, but I'll probably forget. So this is the Dalai Lama's, really, this passage really moved him. Yeah, and it starts off about the snake and the rope, which I've told this metaphor in classes before. I think it's a really great image for this shift of perception. He said, a coiled rope's speckled color and coiled form are similar to those of a snake. And when the rope is perceived in a dim area, the thought arises, this is a snake. As for the rope, at that time when it's seen to be a snake, the collection and parts of the rope are not even in the slightest way a snake. Does that make sense? The you know, the rope, it really is not a snake, and all its parts of, you know, the coiled fibers of the rope are not at all a snake. The snake is merely set up by conceptuality, by this, you know, seeing it in the dark, seeing the rope in the dark in this mistaken way. In the same way, when the thought I arises in dependence upon body and mind, nothing within body and mind, neither the collection, that's a continuum of earlier and later moments, nor the collection of the parts at one time, nor the separate parts of body and mind, nor the continuum of any of the separate parts, and we'll get into all these kind of details later, but none of that is even in the slightest way the I. Also, there's not even the slightest something that's different entity from body and mind that's apprehensible as the I. It's a little commentary on this first verse of chapter 18. Consequently, the I is merely set up by conceptuality in dependence upon body and mind. It's not established by way of its own entity. That's the passage that he was reading. And then he says, suddenly it was as if lightning moved through my chest. I was so awestruck that over the next few weeks, whenever I saw people, they seemed like a magician's illusions, and that they appeared to inherently exist, but I knew they actually did not. This is when I began to understand that it's truly possible to stop the process of creating destructive emotions by no longer assenting to the way I and other phenomena appear to exist. Every morning I meditate on emptiness, and I recall that experience in order to bring it into the day's activities. You know, he recalls this experience from when he was 35, and it was like a lightning going through his chest. Just thinking or saying, I, as in, I will do such and such, will often trigger that feeling, but still I cannot claim full understanding of emptiness. So that's just encouraging words, I feel like, from Tsongkhapa and the Dalai Lama. And I once taught a class on the same chapter 18 at Green Gulch Farm, and some of the topics we bring up in these 6 weeks might be very similar. But if you want, I noticed that class series is still, the audio talks are on the San Francisco Zen Center website. So you can, they're like, they could be an addendum to this class, because I'm sure they won't repeat exactly. But in preparation for that, I remember I had some vacation time, and I went to No Abode Hermitage, down the road from Green Gulch, and spent like 10 days like, okay, we're really going to like, let's really investigate this self through these teachings before offering this class. Let's really like check this out. And it was one of the greatest weeks of my life. Really getting into, you know, meditating on and studying and meditating on this relationship of the sense of me in relationship to body and mind, which is a kind of simple, straightforward thing, and yet there's a lot that can be said. I think it would be easy to pack these 6 weeks. So Dogen Zenji, our Zen founder, also is one of his most quoted phrases is, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And to forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. When actualized by myriad things, the body and mind of oneself and the body and mind of others drop away. So there we have in Zen, one of our classic teachings of Dogen, pointing to the same thing, that to study the Buddha way is to study the self. This is like the central issue. So maybe that's enough background. We could, you know, a lot could be said about how Nagarjuna fits into the history of Buddha Dharma and so on. But maybe let's get right into this topic itself. So these two handouts, one of them, so the white color page has chapter 18 of Nagarjuna's fundamental verses on the middle way, the examination of self. And this first verse is going to be the key verse here. And down at the bottom of the page, it just has this list of the five aggregates of body and mind, because I think it's nice to actually, we've talked about that, I know, here before, but it's nice to go through that again, because that's what we're investigating, but it's what seems to be the self in relationship to, we could say body and mind, but body and mind can be elaborated into five skandhas or aggregates, and you know, what are they? And then the other side of that page is just a reading list. And also at the top, I just included the Buddha's. This is in the Pali Canon, the Buddha's early teachings. This is supposedly the second sutra that the Buddha ever taught. Now, Hannah, who's investigating the early teachings of the Buddha, might say, oh, actually, he didn't really teach this. But this is attributed to Shakyamuni Buddha as the... Remember, we chant in the morning often the Setting in Motion Wheel of Dharma Sutra, and we had a class series on that about the Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path. That's supposedly the Buddha's first teaching ever, and to these five friends of his. And then it seems like just a few weeks later, he taught, in the Deer Park at near Varanasi, he taught the same, this other sutra about the self in particular. And those five friends of his who, when he taught the first one, the first sutra, they, at least one of them, and then the others also, their dharma eye was opened. It was said they entered the stream of practice. And then when this sutra was taught, just shortly afterwards, those five all realized arhat, the fruit of arhatship, which is in early Buddhism the goal of the path. They, you know, what's done was to be done. They accomplished the way. And the gist of that sutra, you know, it's again kind of short, like a page long. And you can print it out later if you like. But the gist of it is, like it says, any kind of form, feeling, perception, volitional formations, or consciousness, the five skandhas, whatsoever, whether past, present, or future, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, is to be seen as it actually is with right discernment as, this is not mine, this is not myself, this is not what I am. This is the on the top of the reading list. It just has this little quote. The emptiness of personal identity in the Mahayana, a reading list. So that's I didn't put that sutra on the reading list, but you can see Samyutta Nikaya for those who like to study all these sources. The Buddha talked a lot about this issue of the self of the person, and particularly in fact, the whole reason for teaching the five skandhas was about investigating the self, that the self is not any one of these five collections of experience. And so there's this whole section in the Samyutta Nikaya, is the collected discourses, big old thick book. But if you happen to have that, you can, this whole Samyutta, this whole chapter is on the five aggregates. And so there's a whole bunch of short sutras that are on the same point. Yes.
Did I just hear you define the skandhas, the aggregates, as types of experience?
I think we could say that. Yeah, five types of experience. Yeah, five aspects of experience. Mm-hmm. We can also call them body and mind. But so when we're talking about body and mind, we're talking about that's our complete experience is just our this body and mind, and body is like the form skanda, and mind is the other four skandhas or aggregates. So body and mind is like abbreviation for five skandhas. So sometimes I think it helps when we're getting into these reasonings and stuff to look at the self and body and mind, because it's so tangible. We immediately have a sense of, we say body and mind, it's like this experience. We say five skandhas, it starts to sound abstract. But I think the more we study the five skandhas, the more you can just hear five aggregates or five skandhas, and you immediately have this sense of like the whole range of body-mind experience. So that's why it's nice to get into the details. Anyway, this reading list has just... I put asterisks by my favorites. So these is, you know, it has Nagarjuna's, all these different translations of Nagarjuna, chapter 18. Then Chandrakirti, who's the one I mentioned, who took the first verse of chapter 1 and the first verse of chapter 18 and combined them into this Madhyamakavatara, the introduction to the middle way. And as it says, chapter 6, verses 120 to 165. If you happen to have a copy of, here's some five different translations. That's a popular teaching. That's the verses that are particularly on the reasonings that we're going to get into about the self and the five skandhas. Chandrakirti really gets into that in, you know, 50 verses or something. In a way, you could say these 45 verses are all commentary on this first verse of chapter 18. If you look at Chandrakirti, and then these general books, which you know they're often on the middle way or Madhyamaka teachings in general, but I put in the page numbers that are particularly on the self of the person, because that's always an issue in these middle way teachings. So, and you know, I think. Often I say in these classes, there's no official homework. You can, you know, just come and listen in class. But I would also add to that, the more you kind of study all these different sources, and different people are going to talk about this in all different ways. For me, I find it's very helpful. It's a very subtle topic, and. You know, some of them are just, you know, 20-page sections. You just kind of read, you get a sense of it. And then, and especially if you have questions about that or brings up stuff, you can bring them back to class. So I think it's great if you have time and you have these books. And as you can see, there's one from each category that's, you know, on the web for free. That's just the whole text is online. These kind of grayed-in ones. So you can always, you know, just read online these things. I just think that the more effort you put into like really unpacking it through these teachings, the more you give to it, the more it will give to you. That's my experience in studying Dharma. Also, when talking about studying Dharma, I like to bring up these three kinds of wisdom. Some of you have heard this maybe a few times, but I think when we get into a really kind of conceptual presentation of teaching, we might think, well, what's this got to do with meditation and just being here and now? So I think this is a nice exposition of the Buddha on the relationship of kind of conceptual study and practice, experiential practice, because there is a relationship. So there's these three kinds of prajna, of wisdom. The first one is a wisdom coming from studying. You know, literally in the early teachings they call it the wisdom from up hearing, because in those early days it was they didn't have books and stuff. So we hear words, conceptual teachings the Buddha taught in words over and over, and all those later teachings came in the form of words. So we hear, but nowadays we have books we can read. So we could say study, the wisdom from studying just, you know, written or spoken words, and understanding what they mean, even without reflecting on them, just understanding what the words say is a kind of wisdom. And then the second one is the wisdom arising from reflection, or, you know, not just taking the words as, well, if that's what somebody said, it must be true, but actually, this is where it gets experiential already. It's like we say, well, is that true in my experience? What the Buddha said, or what these ancestors said, kind of checking it out. And the Buddha always recommended, he said, don't take what I say for granted. You should check this out in your own experience. So there's another kind of deeper wisdom. I think we know this. If we, you know, read something, we hear it, we kind of understand something, but then is that true? Or over time, maybe teachings seep in to our experience more and more, but we can consciously reflect on them also. And that's a deeper kind of wisdom. And then the third, deepest kind of wisdom is the wisdom from meditation or cultivation, or the wisdom of actually becoming the teachings that we've reflected on, where it's completely embodied and experienced without, you know, without any words or concepts at all. We're just like completely living it. And each one is based on the previous. So the Zen tradition tends to kind of like leap right to this last kind of wisdom, just experience directly here and now. You know, it's the separate transmission outside the written scriptures. That's what Zen is, you know, the trademark of Zen. And yet I think it's very challenging to just leap into identitylessness or something like that. Maybe it can happen. But even in Zen, there's many, many teachings that can help us along the way. So I think it's always nice to keep in mind as we get into all these concepts that we're actually, this wisdom is being developed here. Even if we don't feel like it's like deeply affecting our experience, these are the steps. We're like understanding the concepts. Or then, you know, and in the class, maybe we're just trying to understand the basic concepts. Then take it home and reflect on it. We can also reflect on it right here. And then bring it into zazen, bring it into meditation, and check it out in this deeper, really settled, concentrated way. And you might be able to do that even in class, too. Although all these words might distract you. And I heard this image of recently about these three types of wisdom. I thought it's a nice way to remember them. We have Manjushri, Bodhisattva. Manjushri is the bodhisattva, or enlightening being, the archetypal bodhisattva of perfect wisdom. So, and we have on our altar here, below the Shakyamuni Buddha, we have Manjushri riding on the lion. That's a kind of Chinese and Japanese form of Manjushri. He's sitting zazen on top of the lion. So he's, you could say, that's the third type of wisdom, because he's in the zendo. He sits in the center of the zendo, just coursing in perfect wisdom of zazen. But we have other forms of Manjushri that you may have seen, like a typical Tibetan form, and also we have this in Japan, different forms of the paintings or statues of this archetypal bodhisattva. Often he's seen in one hand with a sword, and the other hand is like a kind of flower with a book on top of it, and then he's sitting, you know, cross-legged in meditation. So it's a nice image for He's got the book, which is supposedly the Prajnaparamita, the perfect wisdom sutras. That's Manjushri's specialty, the teachings of emptiness, actually. But in book form, right? Manjushri, this great bodhisattva, like holds this conceptual written teaching. Isn't that interesting? He's got a book. So you could say that's like he holds the first, this first kind of wisdom from study. He protects and holds that wisdom in one hand, and then he's got the other hand of like this sword of like, and sometimes it's a flaming sword, and it's double sided, like with a blade on each side. And this is like the reflection part, like discriminating, sharp, intellect or, really like investigating. Is it this way or is it that way? And is this true or not? It's like the wisdom sword that cuts through murky, uninvestigated delusion, right? And so tentatively, I think we could say that's kind of like the, wisdom from reflecting, cutting through the delusions. It goes beyond just this book. And then in that image, I think it's like his cross-legged posture is like the meditation. Meanwhile, he's just abiding in zazen, in like non-discriminating wisdom of just being, prajnaparamita, of just coursing in emptiness. So that's a nice image to remember. He's got the book, the sword, and the cross-legged posture of zazen. And in the zendo, it's like, well, where's his sword and book? Well, when he comes to the zendo, he puts down the book and the sword and just sits. So I think it's probably not just coincidence. I think that, people thought about these images. So traditionally, the Zen, although Tassajara has a Manjushri with a sword and a book, a Tibetan one, traditionally in Japan and China, the Manjushri in the zendo altar doesn't have a sword and a book. It's just his hands are in meditation posture. But it's the same Manjushri. Okay, so then we have, so that's this page. Then this other handout. And try to remember to bring these so we don't have to keep making copies if you come again. So maybe we could call the page one the types of self and meditation on self and not self. This is something that I put together. It's based on the traditional teachings, but particularly this five types of self was kind of my own creation. They maybe wouldn't list five types like this traditionally, but I think it was just having fun expanding on the lists a little bit. And then we have five types of meditation on self and not self. So this is a kind of experiential meditation that we could do, that I hope we can actually do in class. And then the second page is five kind of refutations, or it's called reasons that inherently exist in self, which is on the types of self on the first page, number three is the inherently existent self. And these are the reasons that one cannot exist. So there's like, this is what Nagarjuna and Madhyamaka system is about, is a lot of like logical analysis and reasoning to kind of like prove to our conceptual mind that things are not the way they seem. And this is a somewhat controversial topic, I think, in itself. This is, I remember last time we studied Nagarjuna, this was somewhat disturbing to people, that especially in Zen, we say, well, don't, trust all your conceptual ideas. It's like, just drop that, let go of all that, and just experience the moment directly. And yet we're using, Madhyamaka, Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti and these people are using very rational, logical analysis is the method of coming to see that things are not how they seem. And it's kind of saying, well, because we're using conceptuality all day long, and and it's off. It's like faulty because it's and there's some really great examples that we'll bring up to show that like our everyday conceptual thinking is like doesn't make sense. It's just we don't investigate. And so this is like investigating on this deeper level and seeing through logic. So it does actually rely on logic. And quite in a way, when you see what it's at the bottom of it, it's quite simple logic, but it's a different way than we're used to thinking. So at first it seems like, huh? Why are they putting things like this? But it's just trying to get to these very basic things that we can agree on that it's like impossible to argue with. And those are like, when we see how those... this kind of like logical kind of proof that things can't like the self of the person cannot exist in the way it seems to, that actually shakes up the our conceptual mind, and at a deeper level, I think it starts to affect us, and I think that's like the second kind of wisdom from reflecting. So it's not the whole story. We have to bring this into meditation, but I think we can start to feel it on this reflecting level of like. Ooh, we start to feel uncomfortable when we start to see that like the usual way our mind works is actually faulty, and like that we rely on so much, the mind and thinking we rely on is like distorted in this really basic way, and I think it's a great uncomfortable feeling that we can hopefully create if we start to feel uncomfortable about the way. That your thinking works and the way sense of self is, that's really great. That means like this is really working. And I think we have to go through that phase.
Yeah. So is it a reasonable model? You know, when we arrive here, we've got a structure that we say is our life, who we are, where we come from, mm-hmm. trajectory. It's like a house that's been built.
Mm-hmm.
And if we want to practice, we have to demolish that house, and we will use many of the same tools to demolish it as we use to build it.
We could put it that way, like demolish the house, but I like to put it as more like we're in this house that we come here in, and the beautiful thing is we don't have to like destroy anything. Actually, we just have to see that the house is really not there. Which is a little different. Sometimes it's like we get into this idea of like we have to abolish the ego or the self, destroy the self to really be free. But that very way of thinking sometimes actually just continues to maintain it because it's like this thing that how are we ever going to destroy it? So that's the beautiful thing about the rope and the snake metaphor is like there's this horrible thing of this poisonous snake on the path in front of me. Like, how are we going to, like, get around this or get rid of it or get it to move? And you just look closer and like, we don't have to get rid of it because it's not a snake. You know, that's the beautiful thing. It's actually a rope. It was my distorted thinking. So that's the beauty of these teachings is there's no self to destroy or get rid of or overcome even. It's just, it's an all matter of seeing clearly. And so it's in a way, it's not even doing anything. We don't have to make this huge, great effort. In a way, maybe the effort is to just see clearly or to understand. And so that's why we need teachings to do this. And sometimes it can happen just in really subtle meditation. The mind just starts becoming aware of itself, and it starts to see like things don't hold up the way they seem. Sometimes we, even without these teachings, and I think that's why we're drawn to meditation, is because we can sit here and maybe we're really angry about something and come into zazen and then we start to sit down and sometimes we can catch that time where it's like, oh, I'm just doing this. That like that person's not here in the room, but like I'm creating this whole thing going about myself and them that's actually like, it's not about what's happening. You know. So sometimes it's very simple like that. But these are tools to be able to like go right to the core of this maybe more quickly. So maybe a good way any questions so far on these three types of wisdom or where we're going with this? Let's keep going into...
I'm just curious how we're going to this is the actual text.
Yeah.
And then you're going to be referring us to these practices.
I think what we'll do is, you know, the reading list, there's this one quote on it that's nice because it's a teaching of the Buddha that's about the same point in the early teachings. And the chapter itself, I think we won't look at for a while.
Okay.
Let's not go into the chapter yet for a while, except maybe this part at the bottom where the five aggregates are defined. We might get to that today, but I think a good place to start is with this off-white sheet and the types of self. I think this is, even before we get into the five skandhas, just to get a sense of what we're talking about here, these types of self, I think, is a... Because we're throwing around this word self now, and it has... We really have to be clear that this is what we're talking about. It means so many things to different people. So, we say self, and we have these other words like ego. I try to steer clear of ego because... it's a kind of psychological term, I think, coined by Freud, I think, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that it literally means, like, self. But, you know, it has this particular meaning in Freudian psychology that I think we just don't even need to go there. It's too limited, I think. Mm-hmm. I think self is more all-encompassing, and then define these five types. Another word is identity. I think that one actually works pretty well. Identity could work for all five of these, I think. So it's maybe we'll go with those for now, self and identity. And so we hear this teaching of, you know, one of the classic Buddhist teachings is no self. But then we say, well, what's this? What's happening here? This is, seems like a self. So here's how to resolve this, these different types. So one is what we call the dependently co-arisen self, and it conventionally exists. So in the two truths of conventional truth, or conventional existence, and ultimate truth of emptiness. So in a way, ultimate truth is like nothing actually exists. That's like the Heart Sutra. There's no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no, and so on. But conventionally, there is eyes, ears, nose, tongue, so on. So without getting too into these two truths, just conventionally, we can say there is this dependently co-arisen self. Dependently co-arisen, I think a lot of people have heard this important Buddhist term. It just means that something is arises in dependence on other factors. That's dependent co-arising. And co is just because it's not so much that one thing causes something else, or this depends on this. It's actually that they co-arise dependent on each other. It's interdependence. So it's not so much like you have this, and then this depends on this. I mean, you can look at it that way, but true dependent co-arising is like, when this arises dependent on this, actually, this also depends on this. The cause depends on the result, as well as the result depending on the cause. But again, without going too far into that, there's just a self right now, body, and this we could, what's defined here as the interrelationship of the five aggregates of form, feeling, perception, formation, consciousness that we'll get into defining later. But just say body and mind right now. The interrelationship of the five aggregates, which includes body, mind, and the whole world, because actually, as we define the five skandhas, we'll see that they include all our, you know, colors, sounds, tastes, touch, and so on, of the world, including the conceptually imputed self, which will be defined as number two below here, inconceivably coming to be from beginningless time. This self is inconceivable, and it's not to be refuted. In other words, we don't need to like see how this one doesn't exist, because it does conventionally exist. Mm-hmm. And it's not a problem. Mm-hmm. It's not, the thing about the self, this inherently existent self that we're going to refute through logic, mm-hmm. is the whole importance here, I haven't mentioned yet, but this is the key thing, the whole reason for this, and I think this would be a nice discussion to have too, is that the The basic teaching is that that belief in this independently, inherently existing self is the cause of all suffering. It's the cause of samsara. It's the cause of greed, hate, and delusion. It's what prevents total freedom. This one, and it's not actually that the self, the inherently existent self, is the cause of it, because it doesn't exist, actually. It's just the view that there is an inherently existent self is the cause. Does that make sense? We'll get into this more later, too. But,
But again, I'm just wanting to repeat back what you said, because I think this is really important. Is the dependently colorism self, I mean, it does exist conventionally.
Yes.
And I think that's one of the troubles sometimes we get into.
Yes.
When we hear no self. We want to go, no, but it does.
Then we say, what's this?
Then what's this?
Yeah. You know, what's our experience?
Little bone shot.
Yeah.
I do have an eye.
Yep.
I do have a nose.
Yep. Yeah.
You know?
Like that.
And so it's like, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We do.
Yeah.
Conventionally,
mm-hmm.
we do. And
yeah.
So it's not something to get worked up about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we do have.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah.
But
in fact,
it exists dynamically and is always changing. Moment.
Yeah. Now there's two here that exist conventionally. That we're going to get. Number two is also going to exist. So this one, this first one, is it's defined, and in a way, this is usually in the tradition they talk more about number two here. I want to just throw in this number one. It's just the interrelationship of body-mind. And I said, it's inconceivably coming to be from beginningless time. It's inconceivable in the sense that, like, we can't actually get a hold of the way this body and mind is coming to be through all these conditions, like right now. You know, we can't actually grasp that. But if there is this whole body mind very, very dynamic experience every moment, right, that includes everything that we're experiencing, but it's so dynamic we can't get a hold of it, and the way it's coming to be dependent on everybody else and all and the whole universe, actually the way it's arising is inconceivable. In other words, if we conceive of it, that's going to be number two. There's this, but before we get there, there's this inconceivable body-mind experience that's, that, you know, take it or leave it. It's kind of like I just threw it out there. We could say, well, we can't, because it's inconceivable, how do we know it's happening? Well, just through the teachings, it seems to be there's the case. It's the ground, and I think we could say we need that because that's the basis on which we're going to create this conceptually imputed self, which is number two. We're going to project something else onto this inconceivable flux of experience. So you get a kind of a sense for that first one?
Mm-hmm.
It's just the inner relationship of body-mind experience with all its dynamism. And it includes number two, which is called the conceptually imputed self. And this is really a neat part here, because this also exists conventionally. And it doesn't need to be refuted. Might be something new here. Is it? It's so this is just an aspect of the dependently co-arisen self, an aspect of number one. You know, it's part of our experiences. We have this sense of me. And it's imagined, but this is the thing, it's imagined to be more than just this part of the dependently co-arisen self. It's imagined to inherently exist. But it's actually merely imputed. And imputed is this word that we had in the last class, right? Of, which means like...
Identify,
like project, yeah, projected. I wrote down a little definition. Attribute. Impute means to attribute or ascribe something, or charge something, or lay the blame on, right? So that's just a Webster's definition of impute. So this is this conceptually imputed self. You know, it's ascribed to, imputed. Independence on the five aggregates of body and mind. It's imagined to it be inherently existing. It's imagined to exist in and of itself. It's imagined to be a real thing, like a substantial entity, a very subtle, obscure one that we can't see, right? But it's imagined to be, like there really is me. We have this sense, there's me. But we can have a sense of me being like a kind of like something to do with these five skandhas of body and mind. But it's just, it's the sense of me, you could say, imputed independence on the five skandhas of body and mind. Also, it's called the mere I. The self, this self, is what I actually refers to, and it's not to be refuted. In other words, it's also not a problem. That's not what's creating suffering. So we have this, because if we say the five, there's this inconceivable mass of five skandhas just flying around and like creating this experience. Obviously, we have more than that. If we can't, I don't think we can quite even live in just that inconceivable flux of experience. We have this sense of, well, there's that, but I have this sense of there's me. It's like a kind of this collection of this five skandhas, or this body-mind experience. But can me be just like an idea, this conceptual imputation that's imputed, and what it uses as the basis of imputation? It's not just randomly, like there's I. What it uses is the five skandhas, is the body and mind experience. We don't think like I am like this, right? We think, and this is what we're going to investigate, of like, the Buddha and these later teachers were just really, got into this really experiential thing of like investigating experience, and that's how they came up with these five skandhas. So what is it when we think of me? Well, it's like, well, sometimes we think it's the body and the sensory experience. We think of feelings, our conceptualization of things, our habits, and consciousness and awareness itself. But none of those things are this essential self. Well, I'm sure we're going to have lots of questions about this, but we use these five kind of building blocks to impute this sense of me.
I want to use the word specify and specification and things like this. Mm. I am the person with this account in the bank. I am the person I was just calling.
We use the word I. Yes. Yeah, and because it would, partly because it would be so inconvenient to say, well, these five skandhas want to go have some lunch now. Yeah. It's easier to say I. And I actually refers to that, the kind of way that the five skandhas, or body and mind, is all working harmoniously together. We use I as an abbreviation, and it's just a convenient imputation. But the problem is, we don't leave it at that. Yeah. That's why we have number three.
So number two owns karma, basically?
Conventionally, number two does karma. And receives karmic effects.
Yeah.
Conventionally speaking, this mere I is a nice way to put it. It's merely, and in quotes, the quotes are intentional there. The I, not like there's some real I, but the mere I, just like the word me or I. I is nice. As we get into this, you see that I has a little different feeling than me. Mm-hmm. I, it's so personal. Mm-hmm. When we think about ourself, we think of I. Mm-hmm. Me is already a little bit more removed. Mm-hmm. You can see the mere I creates karma, mm-hmm. and receives the effects of actions. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that one is quite subtle. This number two, and it's really important to keep in mind. We'll come back to that. And the neat thing is, not only do we not have to, get rid of or refute or see how there aren't five skandhas. I mean, later maybe we say there's no five skandhas, but in terms of this whole class, let's just say we can have dependently arisen five skandhas, and we can also have this conceptually imputed self. It's just a mere I. The mere eyes doesn't cause trouble if we leave it. It's just a mere eye. Right? And it's what I actually, The word I actually refers to, I think that's kind of a neat thing too. This self is what I actually refers to. When we say I, like the Buddha could say, like, I'm going to have lunch now. And when we say, what are you referring to when you say I? I thought you said there's no self. He might say, I refers to this conceptual, you know, overlay imputed onto body and mind. And I'm, you know, I don't have to do that. Like when I go into deep samadhi, I mean, I'm not going to stop doing that. But in order to talk to you about like what I'm doing as I walk towards the kitchen, I'm going to say, I'm going to have lunch now just so we can talk. The Buddha could do that. And that's what I actually refers to, he might say. So then we have this number three, inherently existent self. This is the one that does not exist at all. And this is the innate, meaning like inborn. According to tradition, it's like we're born with this view, which is a kind of funny thing. Because you say, well, babies don't have philosophical views, right? And I think we talked about this in the last class some too. But that's what the tradition actually says, that it's not like a kind of a well thought out, you know, learned view. But I think it does seem to be the case. I mean, I'll go with the tradition on this, and that it seems like we're born with a very subtle sense that there's really somebody here. More than just like this imputation onto, like, you know, a mere eye onto the five skandhas. Now, we don't know if we'd have to be a one-day-old baby to investigate this. We can't remember when we were one. But that's what the tradition says, is that we're born through past karma and past lives. We're born with this view. Before we learned anything, it's what creates the sense of self. And then it develops. It's very undeveloped when we're born. And then it's kind of reinforced as we get older. And not only humans, but all sentient beings, animals, are born with a view. A view is just what it's called. A drishti, a view, is like an understanding, but it's, you know, it's not for animals. It's very coarse, right? But it looks like, I think this is just people investigating how animals seem to live in the world. It looks like they also have this sense of themselves as something that really exists. And again, we have to be an animal to prove it, but as we define these more, we can discuss whether we think this is true or not. Anyway, this is the innate, deeply rooted, very deeply rooted, illusion that the conceptually imputed self, number two, exists by way of its own character. In other words, it's not just a mere imputation, not just a mere like imagination or projection, that it actually exists by way of its own character, which is a kind of technical way of saying it exists inherently. So these are some of the words that are have to define too, because they're really key to this discussion. And here's some of the ways. It exists by way of its own character, from its own side, is one way of saying it. Or inherently, or essentially, it exists in and of itself. In other words, there's something, some other qualities of this inherently existent self are that the three qualities are often mentioned, that it's permanent, but it's not just, we're not just talking about permanence. We got into this discussion last time too, that it's something a little more in addition to just permanence, but that would be a quality of essential inherent existence, is it's permanent. It doesn't come and go or change. But it's also singular, means it's not multiple. This is like one thing. Because if it had like parts, the parts would kind of like depend on each other. You have to have something completely independent. This is another way to say independent. That's the third quality, in fact. Permanent, singular, and independent. Are these three qualities of inherent existence.
So this one would be prone to insult.
Yeah, you could say also that maybe the conceptually imputed self would be prone to insult. But you could say the way that we're really hurt by insult, mm-hmm. I think that is affected. That's that comes to be due to this sense that there's really somebody insulted here.
Yeah.
It's more, you know, I think that, and that's the point.
The boundaries that are being violated.
Yeah, yeah, that there's really somebody here who's essentially violated. And so that's a good example of how our suffering comes from believing that there really is this one. And I think one of the great things here that I hope to get into too is, you know, I think most of us have heard these teachings. We've heard anatman, we've heard there's no self. And we kind of, we're like, okay, I get it. Yeah, there's no, sounds good to me. There's just dependent co-arising. There's no essential self. But the thing is, that's not enough. We can't just, you know, even though we conceptually believe that there's not, some of us, we might say, I really go with that. I agree with these teachings. But yet, we, again, if somebody insults us, then there it is again. Well, do you believe it now? We might say, no, no, I still don't, but ouch!
Yeah.
I think that's like the proof that, I think we could say that's a proof that there's, that this view has not been like seen through.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also all kinds of degrees going on here. I think we can, and the, we can see through this view that we can, and that's what this is all going to be doing, is like kind of like unpacking this, what is this view, and kind of seeing the reasons why it doesn't, can't hold up actually through conceptual reasoning, we're going to see. And then we can maybe even experientially come to the point of actually like, I really like, this is where it gets uncomfortable, like this thing that I think is here is really not here, there's nothing here. I think if it really starts to touch us deeply, it starts to become uncomfortable, because this is our identity we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
We're starting to like undo our like core sense of identity. Mm-hmm. But luckily, it doesn't mess with the five skandhas. We still have our body-mind experience. And it doesn't mess with our conceptually, our mere eye. We still have, well, I'm going to have lunch now, whatever. That one's fine. So it doesn't have to mess with that. So that's why we don't become like some kind of zombie or something.
Mm-hmm.
We can have lunch and say, I'm going to have lunch. But we can come to feel more and more deeply that that's just a mere designation, that there's nobody it's actually referring to. And I think there's some questions about whether this is like an all or nothing deal. I think it's an interesting topic too. Like we can... So the tradition talks about, there's early Buddhism talks about this concept stream entry, right? So a stream enter is defined as, there's basically when this view is like seen through completely, and the view actually drops away, the view of the inherently independently existent self drops away. And not just on the conceptual level, it starts with the conceptual, but when it drops away, like these three kinds of wisdom, on the deepest level of wisdom, like experientially, there's like, we confirm that there isn't the me that I thought there was, or that I maybe thought it is deeper than thought, even that I feel or experience there is. That would be like this breakthrough into the path of like the irreversible path of practice, according to the early teachings. And sometimes they equate in Zen, like Kensho, right? Seeing true nature. Sometimes equated with this, like your true nature is that there's no abiding self. And to like experience that is like a moment of enlightenment or something. But the tradition also very nicely says, this is not the end of the story. In fact, it's the beginning of the story. It's entering the stream. And a way, a very nice way that it talks about this is like, even if that view is seen through, again, it's very, very deeply rooted habitual tendency. So it's going to arise again. Our karmic tendencies are going to give rise to this view, even if we've really seen through it. And that's why people can have these great awakening experiences, and it's maybe even last for weeks or something, and then there's habitual stuff starts to come back, right? And they're like, what happened? I thought I... And maybe they really did see through this view, but then karmic tendencies just, you know, reinforce the sense of self again, because it's kind of maybe uncomfortable to like not know who we are exactly at the core. So, and then there's this, you know, path goes on. Like in the path of practice after this point, one way of talking about it is like the path after that point is just continually reaffirming this absence of this view, or continually, and it might even be conceptually, like you go through the reasonings you've seen through, and then, but now I feel like it's me again. Well, let's do it again. And sometimes they say even before you get to that final level, you go through these conceptual reasonings like over and over, so the conceptual mind is like really convinced, and then and it's gradual process. And so there may or may not be dramatic breakthroughs. There may be like a very gradual thing of like, oh, for a moment I just feel like there's, I'm not caught up in the sense of myself as this, who I think I am. And then again and again. And the practice is then also like when habitual tendencies of greed, hate, and delusion arise, it's like we're reapply them to the view of like, to that view of no inherently existing self. So it's like, you know, I really want that particular lunch, say, and like I really need it for me. And like, then, okay, so like, let's check it out now. And like, let's remember, like, oh yeah. And it could be, if we get more and more skillful, it'd be really quick. It could be like, oh yeah, that's just an old habit that I don't need anymore. You know, that's just, that habit was created based on this false view, and now the view is, doesn't seem so useful. In fact, it's a very painful view. So like, but the habits still arise. So even the traditional teachings say this very beautifully. So there's a long path of practice refining the habits in accord with this new view. So if you feel like, oh, I feel like I've really seen through, but I have all this stuff going on, or somebody says, like, that person's supposed to be really awakened, but look at the stuff that they do. Mm-hmm. I think you could say that people could have this breakthrough really authentically, but then they have all this habitual karmic stuff they have to work through. Mm-hmm. And that's part of practice. Mm-hmm. Yes?
So is this number three, the inherently existent self, is that just an unconsciousness of the five skandhas? Is that
unconsciousness of? Well, it's you.
I'm hearing one of your responses already, that even though we've studied the five skandhas mm-hmm. over and over again. Mm-hmm.
We still have this sense.
And we still have these old karmic patterns that come up
mm-hmm.
all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But is it because we forget? Are we then unconscious of you know, that we've merely imputed this I?
Yeah.
And,
I think it's partly that. And you could say this moment of like... you know, experientially, like, you know, really tasting, not just on a conceptual level or even on a reflectional level, but like a deeply experiential level, like where that's like the Dalai Lama saying, it was like lightning coursing through my chest. I think that's not like, I just understood what the teaching meant. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh my God, all this time up till now, like I felt like kind of secure in who I think I am. Like this moment when it's like, I, you know, the imputation doesn't go away, but like I see that it's really merely an imputation, is like a, you know, a body-mind experience that that's on some level until that point maybe it hasn't really hit us how different it is to experience our life without believing in that, you know, I say believing in that view. So that gets into like, I think part of your question maybe is like, it's not exactly like other beliefs of like, well, I believe in democracy or something. It's like, it's an almost like an unconscious belief.
Taking yourself for granted?
Yeah, it's like we're holding to maybe another word is a misconception I think we could say view, belief, or misconception. It's and it's innate. So we're like, we're very, very used to this misconception.
Where aha becomes uh-oh.
Yeah, aha becomes, well, you know, I think, I mean, it may be different for different people. I think at the point of actually, you know, maybe uh-oh, right before, I think sometimes we're meditating right before the point. It's like, we turn away sometimes, we're like, I'm getting closer, like, ooh, we suddenly feel like uncomfortable, like, let's go watch some TV or something. but I think if it's like at the breakthrough, it's like that's called liberation from suffering. And so it's not at all uncomfortable at that point. It's just unfamiliar, but it's like, that's the direction we're kind of aiming. And people also bring up these examples. If we start to fear our loss of sense of self, these common examples that we all have of when that inherently existing self is not operating. So I recently saw one. Somebody said like playing music. It's like you at first it's like you it's kind of clunky and it's kind of a pain. You're like learning all these scales and you're. You know, it doesn't. You definitely have a sense of self, and like I'm not doing very well. I'm a slow learner, and eventually you learn more and more, until you don't think about yourself so much. You're just playing an instrument, just in this flowing way, and at some point you actually can lose your sense of self, of abiding self, and those experiences where we're like in the flow, where really like the sense of self is not operating, are kind of marked by. The qualities of joy, right? Like bliss even, and very like free flowing. And even though we can't, maybe we don't have that sense of like, this is really great for me. As soon as we're back into that, you know, even music, like, wow, I can't believe I'm doing this. Then like we lose it, right? So, but I think we do have those experiences, everyday kind of things where, we're just in the flow of something, and we're that sense. It's not like the view is eradicated though, right? We're just in the. It's just temporarily not active, and it's such a relief. And so, some kinds of meditation we could say are like one approach to meditating on this whole thing. And maybe this is closer to a kind of traditional Zen view. It's like not get into all this conceptual refutation, but just sit and like let go of that sense, and just like. Just be like you're playing music in this flowing way. And then you kind of like do that again and again until you become more and more familiar with it. And we become more and more accustomed and familiar. And then like it's just not operating in a stronger way. I think that's one valid approach. And this other approach almost can seem like sort of opposite at first. Is like, let's get really into like finding this view, bringing up the sense of self really strongly so we can get a good look at it and then start investigating and kind of like undermining it and so it falls apart. Mm-hmm. But I think that's very valuable because if we do the first kind, just letting go of it again and again, we might not actually notice what's happening. So then when we get into like difficult situations, we can't do it then. We need to be in the Zendo to do it, for example. Whereas this other kind, it's like you see that it applies to everything. It's a kind of understanding that you could bring up even when you're not really calm. You could be very agitated and still like notice, oh, actually, there's karmic agitation arising from past habitual thing, but there's nobody who it's happening to really at the core. Mm-hmm. That's the, I think the in a way you could say this. So the second approach of Nagarjuna reasoning, in a way. Just offhand occurs now, maybe could apply more to like everyday life experience. Whereas the first one is kind of like limited to like if you're doing a lot of meditation because you need to keep going into this really settled, relaxed place in order to do it.
Kinda. So if I'm having a recurring resentment or a phobia about seeing this person running into that kind of thing, mm-hmm. I'm probably operating in this number three area.
Yeah, I think anytime if we're suffering due to, like, well, any suffering, really, mm-hmm. you could say, That would be one maybe strong way to put it. That is that true? Offhand, I think we could say, if there's dis-ease, stress, or suffering at that very time, that view is operating. In fact, that view is kind of turned on at that point. I think so. Yeah. Now, but it's not enough also to say. Is it enough to say, if that view is completely seen through, that's the complete end of suffering? Maybe not completely, because like I say, there could be all these karmic patterns, but in a way, it's like gross suffering is definitely, you know, it's like, oh, like there's still this operating, but it's more like, it's not about, it's happening to me and like my old stuff, you know? So there's still maybe this residue of like, there's a lot of work to do here still. Mm-hmm. But not like, I have to do it. Like, it's got to happen. Mm-hmm. So, we have just a little bit, yeah.
The fear of death.
Yeah.
Is totally dependent on the inherent sense of self. I mean, is there no fear of death without sense of self?
Definitely. That would be a good one. One of the strong connections is on. Because death seems like it's gonna, if we sense it's that core me, it's death seems like the end of that one. So that's the core fear, you could say, the core threat to that inherently existent self is death. Because, you know, unless we have this various other views of like there's this core self that's gonna go on from life to life. But even then, I think. Well, I don't know. That gets into some of these views that are created about multiple lives and so on. So without even going into the last one, since we're almost out of time, I think a nice kind of experiential, maybe homework thing to work on till next week, I think, is locating the sense of the inherently existent self. And that's what the tradition too talks about, like the first step before starting to get into any of the reasonings about how it's not, doesn't hold up and all, is get a really good, strong sense of it. And particularly investigate this point of like, you know, it'll come up. We don't have to worry about that. But we can also do things to bring it up. And when we feel, and what this is we're talking about is the sense of me, the sense of I, when we're threatened, when we're accused, even when we're happy, like anytime we think me, start checking out if you can locate the sense of how it seems like there's something more than the five skandhas. Mm-hmm. See, if it seems like there's more than just body-mind experience, it seems like there's really somebody here. And I think this is a great thing. And in a way you could say, this is kind of not such a pleasant meditation to do, right? It's like, kind of almost solidifying, trying to kind of get a real solid sense of the me. But I think it's so helpful. And in Tibetan traditions, they say, sometimes they'll ask people to do this for months before even getting into this no self. Just like really get into your sense of like the real me. Because without doing that, and you start going through these investigations, it's not going to have much impact. It's going to be like, oh, okay, yeah, no self, that's fine. But if you get this strong sense, and then you can even bring it into the meditations, and you can feel that very sense like dissolving, then it's going to be, we'll get that taste of that. So this is the Dalai Lama, but these are actually traditional meditations. But he's like, these are some exercises you can do to bring up this sense. And they're imaginations, but sometimes they come up, you don't even have to imagine. Imagine that someone else criticizes you for something particularly that you have actually not done. Pointing a finger at you and saying, you ruined such and such. Well, this is the most common one they usually bring up is false accusation. You know, true accusations bring it up too, but a false accusation. It really like, and feel that sense of I, even like our voice, if we're there in the room, if we're going to say something, the sentence will usually begin with a very strong I, you know, or maybe begins with but, You know, but I didn't do it. How could you blame me? So when, at the moment of thinking I or me, like that contract, it's a kind of sense of contraction. It's a body-mind thing. This it's a view, but we're not looking for exactly the conceptual view. It's an experience. Look for this experiential sense of like the me that it feels tight, contracted. Maybe we can feel like in our body. You could try like maybe different times it's different parts in the body or the mind hurts or something. You ruined such and such. You know, watch your reaction. How does the I appear to your mind? In what way are you apprehending it? And then here's the key thing for this, I think, is notice how that I seems to stand by itself, self-instituting, established by way of its own character. Like, it doesn't seem to be just like a changing body-mind thing. Mm. There seems to be, it's familiar. Mm. Like, that's the one that got threatened the last time, too. It's the same one. It's me. You can also say, like, that sense of me that was here yesterday. Like, we have a sense that, like, I'm the same person as yesterday. That's just an ongoing one. Also, remember a time when you were fed up with your mind, such as when you fail to remember something. Like, how could I have forgotten? How could this mind have forgotten? So it's like the self is like blaming the mind, which is kind of neat because then it's not just the same as the body-mind experience, or else why would you blame? Who is it that's blaming the mind, right? There's some self that's like fed up with the mind, right? Remember a time when you were fed up with your body, or with some feature of your body, such as your hair. I can't get my hair in order, or like, you know, my weak ankle or something. Like, why does it keep doing that? Like, so there again, it's not the whole body mind experience. There's some sense of me that has this like ankle or hair that won't go straight or mind that forgets or whatever. Remember a time, or, you know, and I think this is like, if it doesn't come, you can do these. Remember a time when you did something awful and you thought, I really made a mess of things. So it's a little like, instead of I'm falsely accused, like, I think this is kind of like the guilty one, right? Mm-hmm. The guilty, like, I can't believe I did that. Oh, man. And like, it wasn't just a body, mind, karmic, dependently co-arisen thing. I did it. And I am guilty. And it's like, I feel bad about it. Right? So this is just like, that again, and it's a bodily sense often, right? Remember a time when you did something wonderful and you took great pride in it. Yeah, like, I did it. That's so cool. Remember a time when something wonderful happened and you took great pleasure in it. So that's they're all slight variations on the same theme. I think the negative ones bring up the I often more than the positive ones, maybe at least in our culture. But with all of these, it's always notice how that I seems to stand by itself. In other words, inherently exist, independently exist, self-instituting, established by way of its own character, or, you know, existing in and of itself, from its own side. It doesn't need anything to create it. You could say, well, doesn't that event create it? But it doesn't seem that way. I think the event triggers the thing that's already there, is what it feels like to me. It's like, oh, it's just lying there, kind of like enjoying itself, and then suddenly it gets accused, and like, it doesn't feel like the mind and body and its actions got accused, does it? Actually, that is what is happening. It's like, you did such and such. You did it, but it's more like that collection of five skandhas like did seem to do something that I didn't like, even if it really didn't. But we feel like it's much more than that, don't we? That's, I think, this week's experiential thing, is try to get that sense of like, it seems like there's something more than just my body and mind experience. And that's called the view of the independent self. And also see how you can't quite get a hold of it. It moves around through different body parts, different mind parts. It's like, if you try to get a really kind of grasp, let's grab it by the neck and like take a good look in its face. Mm-mm. You can try doing that, but That's the thing about it. You won't be able to, because it doesn't. It's not there. It's very elusive because it has no location. It's a view its job in this life is to simply maintain itself, and it will do so at all costs. Mm-hmm. And the way it's going to do it is it's going to move around. So if you try to get a hold of it here, it's going to move down here. It's like this very sneaky character. And you could kind of say it's like a thing. It's the view of the independently existing self, and that thing that doesn't really exist, but that very strongly we experience. If you can get a hold of it, get a hold of it or experience it, that thing is the culprit. That, strangely, this is a strange thing in Buddhism, that is the cause of all suffering. That's a weird one. So that's, I think, a good investigation this week, too. See if you agree with that. There's the, you got the prajna of learning that fact, that Buddha's teaching, we don't call it a fact, a dharma teaching, that view is the cause and condition of all suffering. Greed, hate, and delusion are all based on that. See if you reflect on that and see if you can try to, I think we should try to refute this. This is one that the texts actually don't get really into, talking about why this is so. They kind of take it for granted. They're like, obviously, this is the culprit. But
we can have a court.
Yeah, let's try to see if we can find the root cause of suffering other than that view. I'd like to do that. So, any final questions about this assignment?
Does that view cause karma? I mean, does karma result from the view?
Yeah, yep. Yeah, karma.
Immediately from day one, you've got the karma.
Karma is based, which means like intentional action is based on the view. Or sometimes we say karma is action done with the view of a self that does it. So yeah, exactly. So that's what we mean by karma, exactly. Thank you. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way unsurpassable.